Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, I'm Casey Luskin, and welcome to ID the Future. In a recent podcast responding to the new book, The Language of Science and Faith, by the neo-Darwinian theistic evolutionists Francis Collins and Carl Giberson, we saw that they claimed that, quote, over time, mutations in DNA can produce novel features, like feathers from scales, unquote. But we then saw that leading evolutionary thinkers have found problems with the claim that feathers evolved from scales, and in fact do not have a good hypothesis to explain the origins of feathers at the present time. Thus, we saw that the argument from Collins and Giberson is essentially outdated. I left off the rest of their sentence because I wanted to address it in a separate podcast. Their full sentence actually reads, quote, over time, mutations in DNA can produce novel features, as we noted earlier, like feathers from scales or eyes from light-sensitive pigment, unquote. There's no citation for that sentence in their book, and Giberson and Collins do not provide us with any documentation to back their claim. In fact, they give it no further discussion, as if they want readers to simply take their assertion on faith. Classical evolutionary explanations for the origin of the eye do assume that the eye can be built via such small step-by-step changes. In fact, Darwin believed the eye could evolve under a scheme of what he called fine gradations. But standard evolutionary accounts for the origin of the eye fall far short of that mark. They lack details, ignore biochemical complexity, and in fact invoke sudden and abrupt appearance of key components of eye morphology. For example, all accounts of eye evolution essentially start with a fully functional eye spot, not mere light-sensitive pigments, as Collins and Giberson put it. As Mark Ridley's textbook Evolution explains, the commonly cited model of eye evolution, quote, began with a crude light-sensitive organ consisting of a layer of light-sensitive cells sandwiched between a darkened layer of cells and a transparent protective layer above. The simulation, therefore, does not cover the complete evolution of an eye. To begin with, it takes the light-sensitive cells as a given, and at the other end it ignores the evolution of advanced perceptual skills, which are more of a problem in the evolution of the brain than the eye, unquote. Now, Ridley calls it not absurd to assume these simple light-sensitive cells as a starting point, but evolutionary biologist Sean B. Carroll cautions to, quote, not be fooled by these eyes' simple construction and appearance. They are built with and use many of the same ingredients used in fancier eyes, unquote. Likewise, after reviewing some of the basic biochemistry underlying the processes that allow vision, Michael Behe, when responding to Richard Dawkins, observes, quote, remember that light-sensitive spot that Dawkins takes as his starting point? It requires a cascade of factors, including 11-cis retinal and rhodopsin to function. Dawkins doesn't mention them, unquote. In fact, no accounts for the evolution of the eye provide an account for this always assumed starting point, which is far more complex than just a few, quote, light-sensitive pigments. In addition to assuming the abrupt appearance of a fully functional eye spot, standard accounts of eye evolution invoke the abrupt appearance of key features of eyes, such as the lens, cornea, and iris. Of course, the emplacement of each of these features, fully formed and intact, would undoubtedly increase visual acuity. But where do these parts suddenly come from in the first place? As Scott Gilbert puts it, such evolutionary accounts are good at modeling the survival of the fittest, but not the arrival of the fittest. As an example of these hypersimplistic accounts of eye evolution, Francisco Ayala's book Darwin's Gift asserts that, quote, further steps, the deposition of pigment around the spot, configuration of cells into a cup-like shape, thickening of the epidermis leading to the development of a lens, development of muscles to move the eyes, and nerves to transmit the optical signals to the brain, gradually led to the highly developed eyes of vertebrates and cephalopods, and to the compound eyes of insects, unquote. Ayala's explanation is vague and shows no appreciation for the biochemical complexity of these visual organs. Thus, regarding the configuration of cells into a cup-like shape, Michael Behe asks while responding to Dawkins again on the same point, quote, and where did the little cup come from? A ball of cells, from which the cup must be made, will tend to be rounded unless held in the correct shape by molecular supports. In fact, there are dozens of complex proteins involved in maintaining cell shape, and dozens more that control extracellular structure in their absence. Cells take on the shape of so many soap bubbles. Do these structures represent single-step mutations? Dawkins did not tell us how the apparently simple cup shape came to be, unquote. Likewise, mathematician and philosopher David Berlinsky has assessed the alleged intermediates for the evolution of the eye and observes the transmission of data signals from the eye to a central nervous system for data processing, which can then output some behavioral response, comprises an integrated system that is not amenable to stepwise Darwinian evolution. As Berlinsky writes, quote, "Light strikes the eye in the form of photons, but the optic nerve conveys electrical impulses to the brain. Acting as a sophisticated transducer, the eye must mediate between two different physical signals. The retinal cells that figure in Dawkins' account are connected to horizontal cells. These shuttle information laterally between photoreceptors in order to smooth the visual signal. Amacrine cells act to filter the signal. Bipolar cells convey visual information further to ganglion cells, which in turn conduct information to the optic nerve. The system gives every indication of being tightly integrated, its parts mutually dependent. The very problem that Darwin's theory was designed to evade now reappears. Like vibrations passing through a spider's web, changes to any part of the eye, if they are to improve vision, must bring about changes throughout the optical system. Without a correlative increase in the size and complexity of the optic nerve, an increase in the number of photoreceptive membranes can have no effect. A change in the optic nerve must in turn induce corresponding neurological changes in the brain. If these changes come about simultaneously, it makes no sense to talk about a gradual ascent of Mount Improbable. If they do not come about simultaneously, it is not clear why they should come about at all. The same problem reappears at the level of biochemistry. Dawkins has framed the discussion in terms of gross anatomy. Each anatomical change that he describes requires a number of coordinate biochemical steps. The anatomical steps and structures that Darwin thought were so simple, the biochemist Michael Behe remarks, actually involve staggeringly complicated biochemical processes. A number of biochemical events are required simply to begin the process of curving a layer of proteins to form a lens. What initiates the sequence? How is it coordinated? And how controlled? On these absolutely fundamental matters, Dawkins has nothing whatsoever to say, unquote. In sum, standard accounts of eye evolution fail to explain the evolution of key eye features like the biochemical evolution of the fundamental ability to sense light, the origin of the first light-sensitive spot, the origin of neurological pathways to transmit the optical signal to the brain, the origin of a behavioral response to allow the sensing of light to give some behavioral advantage to the organism, the origin of the lens, cornea, and iris in vertebrates, and how these structures can be changed without requiring simultaneous changes in other parts of the eye. Guyberson and Collins claim that, quote, "Over time, mutations in DNA can produce novel features like eyes from light-sensitive pigment." But their vague argument provides us with no citations or discussion of the evidence to back up that claim. In fact, much evidence not cited in their book can be found which challenges their claims. It seems that they simply want us to take evolutionary claims about the power of mutations on faith. I'm Casey Luskin. Stay tuned for more reviewing the book The Language of Science and Faith. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.